This is Audible.
Brain over binge. Why I was bulimic, why conventional therapy didn't work, and how I recovered for good. Written by Katherine Hansen. Narrated by Lydia Wente. Notice of liability. This is a personal story of recovery. It is not intended to replace the services of trained health professionals or be a substitute for medical advice. You are advised to consult with your healthcare professional with regard to matters relating to your health and, in particular, regarding matters that may require diagnosis or medical attention. The author and publisher disclaim any liability arising directly or indirectly from the use of this book. This book is for the 19-year-old bulimic who felt hopeless yet swore to conquer her problem one day and then write about it. That bulimic was me 10 years ago. So now I dedicate Brain Over Binge to my former self and to all those who want to be free of binge eating. Preface. Quote, an eating disorder provides solutions to one's problems in life and is not simply about food and weight. Close quote. In November 2007, 2.5 years after I recovered from bulimia, I visited my doctor about some stomach pain. I told him about my past eating disorder because I thought years of binge eating could have caused some damage to my digestive system. Even though I made it very clear that I had not binged in a long time and was no longer bulimic, he asked me, "Do you think your eating disorder is..." He hesitated, so I finished the sentence for him. "Gone?" Then I answered in my own question with a simple, "Yes." "That's great," he said, "so I assume you sought help?" "Yes, I did go to therapy, but then I realized it was just a habit, and I quit." A look of interest, or perhaps doubt, came across his face. "Well," he said, "I'm sure your bulimia was fulfilling some need." Fulfilling some need. The words struck me, and suddenly I felt as if I were sitting in a therapist's office again. I was attempting to write this book at the time, but wasn't making much progress. I found new motivation that day. My doctor's comment made me realize that there is a big problem with the way bulimia is viewed, not just among therapists and patients, but throughout society. Today, eating disorders are primarily thought to be symptoms of psychological problems like depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, and family conflicts. Eating disorder experts assert that the destructive eating behavior signals an inner emotional crisis, just as fever indicates an underlying infection. An affected individual supposedly uses the eating disorder as a coping mechanism to deal with issues and feelings she can't face in her life. In this way, eating disorders are thought to fulfill an important need or void in a person's life, a need that is much more than physical, which is why it's so common to hear that eating disorders are not about food. I believe that the widespread view of bulimia as a complicated problem that helps victims fill some sort of emotional need is a shaky hypothesis at best. And in practice, it can be downright harmful to people suffering daily with incessant urges to binge and purge. A bulimic typically seeks therapy because she can't seem to stop eating large quantities of food. But in therapy, she learns that food really isn't the problem. The problem is her personality, her inability to cope with life, her childhood, and her relationships. In short, she learns that she is psychologically unwell. No one tells her exactly how to stop the behavior she so desperately wants to stop. There are no specific directions, no pinpoint cure. No one tells her she has the power to stop binge eating anytime she chooses. Instead, she learns she doesn't have much control over her own behavior. That is until she addresses the underlying emotional issues. So the bulimic sets out on a path of self-discovery, hoping to find some answers to why she binges, hoping that if she makes some changes in her life, heals past hurts, or builds new relationships, the incredible urges to binge and purge will go away. She learns to deal with depression, reduce anxiety, and build healthy self-esteem. She works on her nutrition, battles her perfectionism, and learns to cope with the events and feelings that supposedly trigger her binge eating episodes. She tries to figure out what purpose the bulimia serves in her life, but all the while, she continues to binge and purge. This was my story for 6 years. After an initial reluctance, I embraced therapy. I embraced the view that my bulimia was about something more than food. I embraced the idea that I was using my eating disorder to cope. I embraced the idea that I was ill, that I needed professional help to get well, and that I needed to get to the root of my problem before I could quit. I did everything I was supposed to do in therapy, and when it didn't work, I tried different therapists, slightly different approaches. But all this held the same result. I remained bulimic. I don't blame my therapist because, after all, they were only trying to help me, and they were always sensitive and supportive. Therapy simply didn't empower me to stop binge eating, and there are many like me who have had the same experience. Although there is a wide range of recovery rates in the available literature, current therapists for binge eaters do not come close to curing everyone. There is no consensus on exact recovery rates because of the problems in research, including a limited number of studies, study design flaws, differing definitions of eating disorders and recovery, different treatment types, and patient withdrawal from studies. However, bulimia recovery rates are not encouraging. And, quote, "we still have much to learn about providing truly effective treatments for eating disorders," close quote. One study showed that after treatment, 50% of bulimics maintained bulimic behavior with episodic remissions and 20% remained symptomatic. Another showed that 3 years after treatment for bulimia, 1/3 of women binged every day, 1/3 binged less than once a month, and 1/3 fell somewhere in between. Even the treatment considered most effective for bulimia, cognitive behavioral therapy, eliminates binge eating and purging in only 30 to 50% of cases. These statistics show that although therapy does help some bulimics, it does not help them all. Therefore, alternatives are needed. After talking to my doctor that November day, I felt a strong desire to provide an alternative. I realize the view of bulimia as a coping mechanism is so pervasive in our society that it is generally accepted as fact, even by those outside of the therapy community, like my medical doctor. I decided that a new voice was urgently needed, a voice to challenge this orthodoxy and reach those who are not being helped by this view of bulimia. I also want to give hope to those who are not currently seeking therapy, because about 9 out of 10 people do not receive treatment for their eating disorder. Fulfilling some need. I thought about those words over and over, trying to understand why my doctor's simple and innocent comment kept lingering in my mind. I reflected on my experience in therapy and how the experts led me to believe that by binge eating, I was using food to cope with my problems, stuff down emotions, or fulfill a more complex psychological need. Then I thought about the way I changed once I decided to view my eating disorder differently. By dismissing the belief that I ate for deeper, more profound reasons and, in turn, completely changing how I approach my problem, I've discovered another path to recovery, a simple and quick way to stop my bulimia, without therapy. I have completely stopped binging, and I have had no desire to do so in years. I believe that I am at zero risk for relapse, even during stressful times in my life. My bulimia is over. When I was consumed with my struggle with bulimia, I vowed that if I ever found a way out, I would write a book to help others find their way too. Sometimes I still can't believe that I've now written this book, because for a long time, recovery seemed so elusive. But my recovery is real and permanent, and I now want to share my story with others so they can use it to end their own struggle. I want to share my alternative approach in hope that I can be a voice of change, a voice for those who are frustrated with therapy, or who simply can't afford it. A voice that helps many escape the daily torment of bulimia. When you are caught up in binging and purging or starving, you don't grow and you miss moments you'll never get back. I lost valuable years to my eating disorder, and I don't want anyone else to do the same. I'm here to tell you that it's possible to end your eating disorder right now and get on with your life. Maybe traditional eating disorder treatment hasn't helped you thus far. Maybe self-help books you've read, while inspiring, haven't truly empowered you to stop your binge eating. Maybe you've tried many paths to recovery that only led to dead ends. Maybe you've realized, like me, that it may take a lifetime to transform into the person you want to be. But you are quickly grasping that you can't wait a lifetime to stop your bulimia. Granted, we all want to become something greater than we are. We want to live with grace, love ourselves, and pursue our dreams unhindered. But that may not be possible for you right now. Maybe you can't even think about flourishing in other parts of your life until you conquer the most pressing issue, the thing that's holding you back, your destructive eating habits. I hope my personal story of recovery can give some people who are plagued with bulimia the courage to expect a cure, and I hope my practical advice will give many bulimics their lives back. I hope I can change some people's attitudes about what bulimia is all about. People like my doctor and my therapist who believe that bulimia fulfills some need. If I can change one person's mind, give one person hope, or save one person's life, I will have done enough. A note to the reader. There are some important things to know before reading this book. First and foremost, this book is a personal story of recovery, not a substitute for medical or nutritional advice. Binge eating and purging can have serious health consequences, especially in those who frequently self-induce vomiting. If you are experiencing concerning symptoms, please seek medical help right away. Although I do disagree with many aspects of mainstream eating disorder therapy, I believe medical monitoring and nutritional support are vital for some people. If you are currently undernourished or underweight, it will be necessary for you to restore calorie intake and body weight to normal levels to be successful in recovery. Starvation affects brain functioning in a way that can render you less capable of making sound decisions. Likewise, the presence of any other mental or psychological disorder that affects your judgment and cognitive decision-making warrants immediate professional help. Some examples are drug or alcohol abuse, incapacitating anxiety or depression, and severe personality disorders. You should also know that this book is for those who want to recover. This doesn't mean you have to be unwaveringly certain of your desire to recover at all times, but at some level you have to want better for yourself. This book is not for someone who can't see any reason to stop binge eating and purging. It is not for someone who wants to continue to deteriorate because of severe self-hatred or trauma. It is not for someone with suicidal thoughts or tendencies. People who don't want to find a way out or have no desire to live need more intensive monitoring and real-time help. Young adults comprise another special group for consideration. Due to incomplete development of the parts of the brain responsible for self-control, the ability to make conscious choices is limited in those around 20 years old and younger. Young people are still capable of making the changes they need to make to pursue recovery, but they may require more direction and support. If you are a parent of a teenager or younger child experiencing an eating disorder, and you want to help guide him or her through self-recovery, I strongly encourage you to find a doctor, therapist, or nutritionist who is willing to monitor your child and work with you to find the support he or she needs while using the approach in this book. Although this book offers a perspective that differs from traditional therapeutic approaches, that doesn't mean it's incompatible with other avenues to recovery. Different ideas work for different people in different ways. This book is not an exhaustive resource that covers every aspect of eating disorder recovery. Rather, it presents a simple approach, and for many, it will be a new and liberating way of looking at things that leads directly to healing. As you read, remember that your recovery will not look exactly like mine or anyone else's. You may recover quickly, or you may see change in a more gradual way, and both are okay. For the sake of simplicity throughout this book, I use the term therapy or treatment to refer to the collective treatment I received for my eating disorder. And I use my therapists to refer to the collective professionals who treated me over the years. During my college years, I saw 3 mental health counselors, 2 psychologists, 3 nutritionists, a psychiatrist, and a medical doctor about my bulimia. I was also an avid reader of anything pertaining to eating disorders. I got much advice from eating disorder experts by reading informational and self-help books and from resources on the internet. Naturally, I don't remember exactly where I learned each specific item of information. So when I say, for example, quote, my therapist told me, or quote, this is what I learned in therapy, it's possible that the advice quoted could actually have come from a self-help book or another expert source. When I do mention specific therapist names, I have given fictitious ones. Introduction. The stories I've read of bulimia recovery are of 2 types. My story is neither of the 2. The first is what I call the butterfly tale. It goes something like this. The bulimic, the caterpillar of the story, is not happy, her relationships are not fulfilling, she tends toward depression and negative thinking. She lacks true direction and purpose in her life. She holds on to hurt from her past, she doesn't like herself. She binges and purges, supposedly to deal with her pain, but that only makes her more miserable. Then she enters the recovery process, the cocoon, And there she works to resolve issues from her past, learns how to cope with everyday problems and major stressors, learns how to manage feelings and emotions, and finds peace within herself. The recovery process is not comfortable, it's hard work, and the transformation inside the cocoon can take an extremely long time. But when the bulimic is finally ready, she emerges as a fundamentally changed person, the butterfly of the story. She has become happy and fulfilled. She's in touch with her feelings and involved in satisfying relationships. She's at peace with her past and is able to live joyfully in the present. Her ambitions for the future are quickly becoming reality. As a result of her transformation, she no longer needs to hold on to her eating disorder. She can fly away. The second type of recovery tale is what I call the tamed house pet story, and it goes something like this. The bulimic, the untamed animal of the story, lives a destructive and dangerous life. She binges and purges, and in so doing, she finds herself isolated, struggling through every day and never safe from her bulimia. Then she enters the recovery arena and begins the arduous process of taming her disordered eating behavior. After much training, practice, attention, and patience from therapists and support networks, she learns to reduce her binge eating and purging. She may even stop these behaviors, for the most part, after a long and difficult recovery process. This type of recovered bulimic is like a wild animal who is taken into a home, trained diligently and painstakingly, given much attention and care, and learns to live a new and better life. However, even though the house pet learns to behave correctly most of the time, it still retains its untamed instincts at some level, and the owners may never be fully confident with the house pet in all situations. In this type of recovery, an occasional binge is excused, just as occasional inappropriate behavior is expected from a tamed house pet. The bulimic falters every now and then, but she gets back on track afterward. Her relapses are welcomed as learning experiences or as signals that something else in her life needs attention. When they occur, the bulimic seeks support, tries to address what she believes to be the underlying emotional cause of the binge, and learn some new coping skills as to avoid binges in the future. This type of recovery eventually becomes fairly secure. However, the recovered bulimic can never get too comfortable. She has to take it one day at a time. Just as the owner of a tamed house pet has to keep it away from or train it to deal with anyone or anything that could trigger its past behaviors, the former bulimic has to either avoid or ensure she copes with things that could send her back to binge eating and purging. She has to be on guard against feelings and life events that could allow her untamed ways, her binge eating and purging, to return. These events and feelings are termed triggers in the eating disorder community. The recovered bulimic has to continue to deal with issues from her past, ensure that her emotional needs are met, and make sure she eats the right type and quantity of foods to avoid triggering a relapse. The improved quality of life for the tamed house pet former bulimic is undeniably a vast improvement over the daily torment of binging and purging. Just as the pet animal is unquestionably better off than when it was living on its own, but remaining free of bulimic behaviors is certainly not effortless. It takes constant maintenance. When I was in the depths of bulimia, none of these stories made sense to me. Butterfly tales of triumph are commendable and inspiring and no doubt very real. But in 6 years of trying, I found I could not relate to the idea of a long journey into a rich and full life while struggling daily with my incessant urges to binge. My failure to transform myself into a butterfly wasn't for lack of effort. Sure, I wanted to become happy and fulfilled, but that was not happening for me. Especially while I continued to eat thousands of calories at a time and while I was exercising to exhaustion to try to undo the damage to my body. No matter what I uncovered from my past, no matter what I resolved in the present, no matter what I envisioned for my future, my urges to binge eat still consumed me. No wings grew, no brilliant colors appeared. No matter how well I managed to cope with emotions and feelings and conflicts and problems, I still gave in to those urges time after time. As time went by, I saw what should have been some of the best years of my life quickly passing. I began to think that if I was waiting to become a butterfly to stop binge eating, I could be waiting forever. I began to think that the tamed house pet type of recovery was my only chance at a semi-normal life. Yet, the tamed house pet recovery stories didn't really appeal to me any more than butterfly tales did. These stories didn't even promise the complete freedom of the butterfly tales, because even after recovery, the bulimic is still very much reliant on therapists, therapeutic techniques, and support systems in order to remain recovered. I was tired of meal plans. I did not want to have to follow one every day after recovery. I did not want to continue going to therapy and support groups indefinitely. I did not want to have to deal with my bulimia one day at a time. I wanted to be free of it, completely. I wanted recovery to mean a life where I would no longer have any desire to binge eat, no longer have to be on guard against triggers, and no longer binge. Ever. As I write today, I am completely free of binge eating, purging, and any type of disordered eating. I do not have to watch out for triggers, and I don't have to follow meal plans or attend therapy. I no longer have any urges to binge, and there is no possibility of relapse. Yet my recovery did not involve any major self-transformation. I found another way to end my bulimia. My daily struggle with food is finished. The pain that my habits brought me has disappeared. The misery of those years of binge eating is gone. The relief I feel to have put my eating disorder behind me is beyond words. My recovery was not typical. It did not involve special diets, emotional self-discovery, or spiritual enlightenment. It did not result from a decrease in anxiety, an increase in happiness, an improvement in self-esteem, a new medication, or any major life change. It was simply me, armed with a bit of knowledge, finally taking control of my own behavior. Today, perhaps I'm not the perfect, successful, confident, shining example of what a recovered bulimic should be. In love with life and in love with myself. But each day, I do have the opportunity to live a real life, with all the joy and pain it brings. I still have many of the same faults, problems, and weaknesses that I had when I was bulimic. But without the bulimia, those problems are immeasurably more manageable. I now have a family of my own, and I can be available to them and to all the people I care about. Without my bulimia consuming me, I'm better able to tackle the daily challenges that I face, even if I don't always cope well. I hope that my story will point other bulimics in a new direction, away from the myths of the butterfly theory of recovery and the constraints of the tamed house pet theory of recovery, and toward an alternative path to secure and lasting recovery. I believe that at any time we choose, we can use our own resources to end bulimia. This book is divided into three parts. Part one is a memoir of my eating disorder and my recovery. I share how my bulimia developed and grew over the years, my experiences with unsuccessful therapy, and how I finally conquered bulimia on my own. Part two is an account of my journey to figure out what my bulimia was all about to begin with, and to explain to myself how I was able to recover so quickly and completely. The answers I found were surprising to me and very different from what I had learned in therapy. Part 3, I discuss topics that were often the focus of my unsuccessful therapy, such as low self-esteem, poor body image, coexisting problems, and eating a normal diet. In this book, I primarily address bulimics and those with binge eating disorder, BED. But anyone dealing with episodes of binge eating can benefit from what I've written. For those who are unsure if they fall into this category, here is a definition of binge eating, adapted from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, published by the American Psychiatric Association. An episode of binge eating is characterized by eating in a discrete period of time, for example, within any two-hour period, an amount of food that is definitely larger than most people would eat during a similar period of time and under similar circumstances, and by a sense of lack of control over eating during the episode. For example, a feeling that one cannot stop eating or control what or how much one is eating. Binge eating disorders affect many people. BED is more common than bulimia, with an estimated 2% of all adults in the U.S. affected, as many as 4 million Americans. according to a 2001 report. Bulimia occurs in about 1%, although the rates are probably much higher because bulimics often hide their disorder from others. Furthermore, bulimics are harder to identify because they do not have emaciated bodies like anorexics. Among teen girls, bulimia may affect as many as 5%. So far, I have used a female perspective in describing those with eating disorders, but this book can benefit men as well. Although 90 to 95% of those with bulimia are female, males can develop the disorder too. BED affects more men than bulimia. For every 3 females with BED, there are 2 males, which amounts to well over 1 million men. For ease of writing, I will continue to use feminine pronouns. However, this book is not excluding males. And in fact, my ideas may be especially appealing to males who feel alienated by female-oriented, emotionally intensive talk therapies. It doesn't matter if you are male or female. It doesn't matter how old you are, how frequently you binge, how long you've been doing it, or how large the quantities of food you consume. Binge eating can create havoc in your life. So even if you don't quite fit the typical pattern of bulimia or BED, or you don't meet the diagnostic criteria for either disorder, you may be able to relate to my story and find help in this book. A word of caution. All this book can help you do is end your destructive eating habits. It won't tell you how to become assertive, spiritual, emotionally satisfied or happy, or solve any of your other problems. It won't teach you how to love yourself, build meaningful relationships, heal hurt from your past, eat a perfect diet, maintain your ideal weight, or exercise optimally. Recovering from an eating disorder will not magically change you into the person you want to be. That's a lifetime's work. But putting aside your bulimia or binge eating disorder can be the first step in a process of self-transformation, if that's what you desire. Reading this book certainly won't give you wings, but it will give you hope. And more importantly, it will give you a clear path to recovery. Part 1. My Bulimia and Recovery. Chapter 1. A Typical Day's Binge. It was near midnight on January 6, 2000. I lay on an old couch in the basement of my college dorm, a Pop-Tart wrapper and empty diet Sprite bottle at my side. As I began to wake from a deep sleep, I noticed the back of my shirt was damp, but it was so hot in the basement that I wasn't sure if the moisture was sweat or soda. I didn't really care. All I could think was, I can't believe I've done it again. This was supposed to be a new year, a new semester, and a new start. I had vowed not to binge eat in the second semester of my freshman year, yet here I was, full, bloated, and sick of myself. I sat up and stared down at the couch. It was gross, muted purple, spongy with brownish stains. I thought that any other freshman girls who had been there had probably been drunk because no one would have been on that couch if they were thinking clearly. I only wished alcohol had brought me here. That would have been okay for a college freshman, but for me it was not beer, it was food. I was so ashamed. It was only my first day back at the university after spending the holidays with my family, and it was already a disaster. The holidays, too, had been a disaster. I had binged many times at home as well. Yes, everyone overeats during the holidays, indulging in treats that come around only once a year. But for me, it was different. During every meal, I struggled with controlling myself, trying to eat slowly and take small bites. I always tried to be mindful of how hungry or full I felt as I ate, but this was very frustrating because I was rarely satisfied. No matter how much I consumed at a meal, I usually wanted much more. I indulged like everyone else during Christmas dinner, but afterward, I longed for our guests to leave and my parents to go to bed so I could truly eat the way I wanted to. I wanted everything to myself. The stuffing, the sweet potatoes, the pies, the cookies, the chocolates. I wanted to eat fast, swallowing large mouthfuls at a time until I was dizzy. I tried to talk myself out of it, but I couldn't reason with myself when I had such strong urges to binge. If I hadn't experienced the urges for myself, I would never have believed that such strong cravings for something so irrational were possible. and I wouldn't have believed that saying no to something harmful could seem completely out of the question. I had always been a conscientious person who valued personal responsibility and good choices, but my urges to binge made me throw all of that out the window. Christmas night was one of those times when my conscientious self seemed completely absent, and saying no to my irrational desire to binge seemed unfathomable. So as soon as I was alone, I walked slowly into the kitchen, trying to remain calm even though my heart was racing. I told myself I would only have a little, as I usually did before a binge. Possibly one more piece of pecan pie, because it was Christmas after all, and I could always work out the next day to make up for it. I told myself I wouldn't let a little snack turn into a binge, but halfway through the first piece of pie, I knew I would eat much more. My heart beat faster, and I began taking bigger and bigger bites. In a matter of minutes, I had eaten two more pieces of pecan pie, two pieces of cherry pie, six Christmas cookies, and 10 chocolate candies. I still know what I ate during binges many years ago because I always wrote it down the next day in my journal. I let go of all self-restraint, and it felt good. I proceeded to eat from the leftover dishes until it was no longer pleasurable to eat. That is, until I was hunched over with stomach pain. Then I poured myself a large bowl of cereal and took it back to my bedroom. I sat up in bed, eating each bite slowly, wondering if I could die from overeating. What could happen to me? Could my stomach burst? Could my esophagus tear? Could I go into shock from too much sugar? Surely what I'm doing won't kill me, I thought. Will it? Such questions always popped into my head after a binge, but I tried not to pay too much attention to them. I didn't want to think about what might happen. I also didn't want to think about how much weight I'd gained, about having to spend the entire next day at the gym to make up for my binge, and about going back to college. I only wanted to be full. I wanted to drift off to sleep feeling satisfied, sugar drunk, and content. The beginning of a binge always brought excitement, relief, and gratification, as if I were finally giving my body what it wanted, as if I were doing the right thing, even though part of me knew it was terribly wrong. However, the feelings of pleasure were all too fleeting. As I continued to binge, the good feelings gradually faded, leaving me wanting more and more to recapture them. This will be the last time, I thought. It was not the last time. I binged again 2 days later, and again 3 days after that. Then I made a firm resolution to stop as we rang in the new millennium, which was the first of many New Year's resolutions to stop binge eating. That resolution lasted only until I binged again on January 3rd, 3 days before I was to drive back to school. I thought maybe I'd have better luck quitting once I got back to campus, once I no longer had to deal with the stress of living back at home, and once I had access to my therapist and nutritionist again. So on January 3rd, I promised myself I would quit binge eating for good once I got back to the university. Driving while eating. But here I was on January 6th, lying on a disgusting old couch in a basement, feeling as full as I had on Christmas night. I wanted to rewind time and take back all I had eaten that day. My binge had begun that morning, about a quarter of the way into my 4-hour drive. Even though I'd eaten a meal before I left the house, I'd begun feeling the familiar urge to binge just an hour later. I'd briefly tried to talk myself out of it, but then quickly decided, since my promise to quit binging did not technically start until I was back on campus, that it was okay to eat in the car on the way. I reached into the back seat and blindly dug through my luggage for the large bag of Christmas M&Ms that my mom had given me to share with my roommate. The M&Ms were gone in minutes. Then all my focus and energy turned to getting more food. When I began to binge, it was if I entered a trance where nothing else mattered. Not driving, not listening to music, not my cell phone ringing, not making plans for next semester. All that mattered was where I would get the next sugary and fattening item for my binge. I knew it was wrong, disgusting, gluttonous, abnormal, costly, unhealthy, and irresponsible. But in that moment, I didn't care. I took the next exit. I bought Doritos, Rice Krispie Treats, and Honey Buns at a gas station. And before getting back on the interstate, I pulled into a fast food restaurant for a chocolate shake. I exited four more times to get more food before reaching my college town. Then I decided that I could squeeze in a few more stops before I was officially on campus. So instead of going straight to my dorm, I drove around town from one place to the next, avoiding the route to the university until I simply couldn't eat anymore. Finally, around 4 p.m., I took the two-lane road to my residence hall, going below the speed limit with a line of cars behind me. "I have to stop this," I scolded myself as I pulled into the parking lot. I got out of the car feeling nauseous and dizzy. My stomach was full and tight. I felt sick as I looked at the 8-story building in front of me. I wanted to like college. I wanted to make friends, go out, date. But my irrational and unrelenting desire to binge was getting in the way. I was too uncomfortable to carry anything to my dorm room, so I left my luggage, trash, and some uneaten food in the car. Opening the door to the building, I felt in a daze as I heard girls talking about the holidays, upcoming sorority events, and what classes they were taking. I stared at the tile floor as I walked the elevator, hoping I wouldn't see anyone I knew. My face was swollen, as it always was after prolonged binges. I was unsure whether I'd gotten all the crumbs off my face, and I certainly didn't want to talk to anyone. Three girls boarded the elevator with me. One of them was telling her friend about gaining weight over the holidays because she'd eaten so much. This was typical conversation in a college dorm, and it seemed I couldn't get away from the talk about calories, weight, and working out. I hated the fact that other girls were so concerned about their weight, even though I was probably more concerned about mine than anyone. I thought that if that girl had only known what I'd eaten over the holidays, she wouldn't feel so bad. I was still the thinnest one on the elevator, but I was gaining weight by the day. I was severely underweight when I began college in August 1999. By January 6th, I'd already put on 15 pounds from binge eating. The girls in that elevator looked healthy and beautiful to me. I thought of how wonderful it would be to be like one of them, to be of average weight, not starving, not stuffed, and only concerned with eating a few extra calories during the holidays. Instead, I was concerned about eating over 7,000 calories in the car and wondering why I still wanted more. The three girls got off the elevator on the third floor and the door closed behind them. My dorm room was two floors higher, but the elevator ascended and the number 5 lit up. I didn't move. I watched the door open and close. What's the point of trying anymore? I stepped forward and pressed the B button. Lo. Downstairs, I walked the empty hallway, past the basement lobby, past the laundry room, and into a small room with vending machines. I bought a bag of chips, a candy bar, a Pop-Tart, and a bottle of Diet Sprite. Then it was back to the basement lobby to sit in the old, disgusting couch. The food was no longer enjoyable, and I felt sick. But as long as I kept eating, I didn't have to think about anything else. I only had to chew and swallow. I felt completely numb. It wasn't until I'd eaten the last bite of Pop-Tart that I started to feel uneasy. As I slowly returned to my senses, what I'd done that day became very real to me. The shame, the guilt, and the self-hatred set in. What made it worse was that I hadn't even been back on campus for 15 minutes, and I'd already broken my promise to myself. I began to panic. I knew I had to do something to fix this. I had track practice in 2 days, and I felt too fat to walk, much less run. I feared that everyone on the team would stare at me, wondering why I was gaining so much weight. I felt that I could not live with myself if I gained any more weight in this horrible and disgusting way. I got up from the couch, walked to the trash can, and tried to vomit. This was not my first time trying. I had begun trying to make myself throw up after binges several months before. But no matter how hard I tried, it hadn't worked. Sometimes I felt content after binges, like the one on Christmas night, and I'd go right to sleep. But other times, I felt desperate to get rid of the food. This time, I was desperate. I gagged so hard my face burned and my eyes watered, but nothing came up. I gave up after 15 minutes. I collapsed in tears on the couch. If I could just make myself throw up, it seemed to me all the problems would be solved. Then I'd be able to binge, which was all I seemed to want to do, and which seemed impossible not to do, without suffering the consequences. Inside myself, I knew that throwing up would only make things worse. But at the time, it seemed like an easier solution than my usual one. Exercising the entire next day. I was so exhausted at this point that I couldn't even think about working out. I felt too tired and sick to even make it back upstairs to my room. I only wanted to sleep. I curled up on my side on the couch and drank my diet Sprite, thinking how ironic and ridiculous it was that often I ended my several thousand calorie binges with a diet drink. The carbonation made my stomach feel a little better, and the warmth of the basement made my eyes heavy. The last wrapper. I woke up near midnight with the dampness on my shirt and with the usual after effects of a binge. Swollen stomach, puffy face and hands, acid reflux, a sore throat, and a horrible taste in my mouth. All I could think about was how fat I felt and how much of a failure I was. In the darkness of the basement, among the shadows of a few boxes, some folding chairs, a splintered table, and an old piano, it all felt like a bad dream. I picked up the soda bottle and Pop-Tart wrapper from the couch and made my way back toward the elevator. I can't bear another semester like last one, I thought. And this was already shaping up to be worse. I recalled the last several days of the previous semester, the worst week of my binging thus far. I had binged on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. I was up all night eating on Sunday, even though I had a chemistry final the next morning. After my exam, I felt so fat that I decided to keep eating. There were free donuts in my dorm's lobby during exam week, so I downed 11 of them, plus 2 cartons of chocolate milk. Now the dorm was quiet. There was no end of semester hustle and bustle, no donut table. It was a new start. But I felt the same, miserable and bloated. I boarded the elevator, rode up to the 5th floor, opened the door to my dorm room, and looked around the tiny dark space feeling sick and hopeless. I threw the empty diet Sprite bottle away and I put the Pop-Tart wrapper in my desk drawer. I told myself that since I would never binge again, I wanted to save the wrapper. It would be a memento of sorts, a token of my last binge food. It would remind me of these dark days, and one day I'd be able to look back on them and laugh, or maybe cry. I wasn't sure which. I closed the desk drawer and got into bed. My roommate, let's call her Julia, wasn't there. She was home with her family for a few more days. I felt such shame when I thought about her, because I had eaten so much of her food the previous semester. At first, I thought she wouldn't notice the small items I'd swiped here and there. A few cookies, a bowl of cereal, some crackers. I usually hurried to the store to replace the food, but as it turned out, she knew all along. A few months into our first semester, Julia had begun hiding certain foods. In some of my binge eating episodes, I'd searched everywhere for her food, finding a pack of cookies in her clothes hamper, some snack cakes under her bed. She also kept an unopened box of honey buns in a small plastic drawer between our beds for over 2 months. She wasn't hiding those from me, simply storing them there until she got around to eating them. But that box taunted me. During binges, I would check to see if it was open yet, and I was always furious when it wasn't. If she would just open the box, I could sneak just one. During one binge at the end of the semester, I decided that Julia would surely not eat those honey buns before she went home for the holidays. I opened the box and ate all but one, along with some of her hidden cookies. Then I went to the library to study. When I came back later that night, I noticed that something was wrong. All of Julia's food was gone. There was none on her food shelf, none in the refrigerator, none in her usual hiding places, no remaining honey bun in the drawer. It was all gone. And she was too. My heart sank with shame. Until that point, Julia had been at least outwardly easygoing about me eating her food. "That's fine, you can have as much as you want," she would say after I told her I'd eaten a bowl of her cereal or a few of her cookies. But understandably, she'd been getting annoyed over time as I abused her generosity. So that very night, I ran out to the grocery store and bought what I hoped was enough food to make it right. What I'd guessed I'd consumed all semester. Back in our dorm room, I laid out all the groceries on Julia's bed, along with a self-help book for bulimics, which I was reading at the time. I added a letter, explained to her that I had been diagnosed with bulimia and had a hard time controlling myself during binges. I apologized for my behavior and confided to her that I was seeing a therapist and a nutritionist. I told her if she had any questions or concerns about the disorder, she could talk to me or read through the book. That night when Julia came into the room, I pretended to be asleep. I listened in embarrassment as she put all the food away. The next day, she wrote a kind letter in response to mine, forgiving me and offering encouragement and support. We never talked about the incident, and we'd both gone home for the holidays 3 days later. Now I stared at my roommate's empty bed, wondering if our relationship would ever be the same. Chapter 2. A Typical Day of Purging. I was glad my roommate wasn't back at the dorm room yet, because I knew I couldn't face her just now. She had been one of my good friends in high school, and I hated the fact that I had wronged her by stealing from her last semester. I also hated that she now knew this embarrassing secret about me. I was also worried that I wouldn't be able to stop myself from eating her food again. Surely I can control myself, I thought. Even as I stared through the dark at all the food Julia had left in the room. As I tried to go to sleep that night, I thought about the first time I'd lain in this dorm room bed 5 months earlier. I'd been so thin that I then couldn't lie on my side because my hip bone jabbed me on the too firm mattress. Those were the days when my weight still reflected my anorexia, not my emerging bulimia. I hadn't had any misconceptions about how thin I was when I'd entered college. I hadn't had a disordered body image. I'd known I was underweight, and part of me liked it. It made me feel less guilty about occasionally binging. My binge eating had just been starting to pick up then, but now it seemed totally out of control. I could no longer feel my bones, even though I was still very lean. I knew I needed to gain the weight I had my first semester, but I didn't like the way I'd done it. I felt driven to binge by some force beyond my control, and I feared the scale would just keep escalating. I have to somehow take control and make it stop, I told myself, reaffirming my vow that January 6th would be my last day of binging. I'd exercise the whole next day and then start over. Getting back on my nutritionist-approved meal plan and returning to work on my therapy goals. At last, I fell asleep. Gym, prison. I didn't wake up until 11 a.m. on January 7th, and the first thing I noticed was my terrible headache. I resentfully got out of bed and began packing for the gym. 3 sets of workout clothes and some fruit and crackers. On the days after binges, I wore only sweatshirts and sweatpants to hide my bloated body. I'd need 3 sets because I always sweated profusely and had to change a few times during the day. This day, I followed my typical post-binge routine, alternating working out on the stationary bike, the elliptical machine, the stair climber, and the treadmill. I stayed on each machine for an hour or two, then went to the locker room to change my sweat-saturated clothes and refuel with some healthy food before returning to the cardio area. Throughout my first year of college, I'll do about 4 hours of cardio and lift some weights on days after binges, but as the years went by and the pounds piled on, I increased my load to about 7 hours of cardio plus the weights. I hated it. I despised working out purely to compensate for a binge, and I resented having to spend my days at the gym. I passed the time on the machines by studying or reading, but it was still monotonous and exhausting. The binge was never worth the price, and it was during those long hours at the gym that I most wished for a different life. When I finally finished my workout sentence on January 7th, I showered, dressed, and felt a great sense of relief. The slate had been wiped clean. Even though I knew my exercise hadn't burned as many calories as I had consumed the day before, my tired body and the scale told me that most of the damage was undone. I always weighed myself before, during, and after workouts, and I generally lost about 5 pounds. Most of it was water weight from sweating so much, in my heavy clothing, but it still made me feel better to see the numbers on the scale go down throughout the day. It was dinner time when I finished working out that evening, so I drove toward the nearest sandwich shop. Even though I didn't eat much while exercising, I wanted to get back on track afterward with a nourishing, nutritious dinner because I knew that skipping meals or eating too restrictively would just lead me to binge again. Tired as I was, I had a new, more positive outlook as I drove away from campus and into town. Maybe the semester can be different after all, I thought. I told myself I would not spend any more days binge eating or over-exercising, and I would eat normally and be healthy from now on. As I continued down the road to the sandwich shop, however, my stomach began growling, and my new confidence began to fade. My hunger made me anxious because I felt my insatiable appetite was my enemy. When I was hungry, I couldn't trust myself not to overeat. After I finished a large turkey sandwich and baked chips, I was no longer physically hungry, but I still felt empty. Exhausting urges. On the drive back to my dorm, I started wanting to eat more. I contemplated stopping at a nearby gas station, one of my regular spots, to get more food. I hated the fact that I had these incessant thoughts about binging. Why couldn't I stop thinking about food? Why couldn't I just stop needing to eat unreasonable amounts of it? I became very anxious as I got closer to my dorm, and I wondered if I'd be able to fight my desire. Would I be able to resist my roommate's food all alone in the dorm room? I knew all the logical reasons I shouldn't binge again, and I certainly didn't want to undo my day's worth of working out to have to repeat the workout the next day. Furthermore, I couldn't afford to binge again because I had track practice the next morning, and I couldn't run well feeling sick and bloated. But no amount of reasoning could turn off my desire to binge. In fact, nothing I had tried up to this point was effective in stopping my irrational thoughts and feelings. When I did manage to not binge, it felt like a painful struggle, as if I were denying myself something vital. That night was one of those times. From the moment I left the sandwich shop, I was consumed by cravings to binge, and I fought them most of the night. I tried using logic. I tried using strategies I'd learned in therapy. I tried distracting myself. I tried relaxing. I tried sleeping. But I did not sleep much. I certainly didn't relax. I wasn't able to distract myself for more than a few minutes. I didn't make any important therapeutic gains, and I certainly didn't outsmart my urges with logic. When the sun came up the next morning, January 8th, I still had not binged, but I didn't feel victorious. I felt exhausted and depressed. The fight didn't even seem worth it. At least on the previous night, when I'd binged, I'd gotten a good night's sleep. Now, instead of running at track practice feeling bloated and sick, I would have to run sleep-deprived. It seemed I just couldn't win. Even if I did resist my urges to binge, they still got the better of me. I knew it wouldn't be long before they would return, and I didn't feel capable of putting forth so much effort to cope with them day after day. So only 2 days later, I broke all the promises I made to myself and binged again. I found myself back at all my regular snack shops and fast food chains. Afterward, full of shame and self-disgust, I threw away the Pop-Tart wrapper from my desk drawer and replaced it with a potato chip bag, the last item I'd eaten during this binge, and told myself that it was truly over now. I again over-exercised the next day to compensate for my last lapse, and I again felt renewed after my workout, determined to start over. I was successful for a few days at a time, only to eventually succumb to my desire to binge. This cycle was repeated over and over. I didn't understand why I was caught up in this pattern, despite my efforts to figure it out in therapy and in self-help books. I didn't understand why I was so ravenous, why I thought about food constantly, why eating normally was near impossible for me, and why I broke promise after promise to quit. I hated having to deal with my cravings day in and day out, and I hated that I was wasting valuable time binging and then compulsively exercising, yet I couldn't seem to stop. This cycle, my pattern of bulimia, hadn't developed overnight. It was a process that had begun slowly, the summer before my junior year of high school, when I first began trying to lose weight. Chapter 3. Choice and Consequences. My decision to lose weight wasn't deliberate. I didn't think I was fat. I didn't tell myself I needed to lose X number of pounds to look good. Dieting was something I inadvertently fell into, then chose to continue. I had always been a super skinny kid, but when I entered high school, I started filling out as teenage girls should. During my 9th and 10th grade years, I put on about 15 pounds, which put me at a perfectly healthy and still thin weight for someone my age and height. I no longer look like a skinny little girl, but more like a woman. The additional pounds didn't cause me much grief at first. At the time, some of my friends were becoming conscious of their weight and were beginning to diet. I actually thought dieting was ridiculous and wasn't afraid to tell my friends so. My diet was generally healthy and normal, and for quite a while, I didn't give it much thought. I ate whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted, and I stayed very active. I was on the cross-country baseball and swim teams, and I was the pitcher on the softball team. I was, and still am, a person who can eat a lot and stay thin because of my activity level and metabolism. So although I usually ate more than my friends at school, I remained thinner than most. Nevertheless, as I saw the numbers creeping higher and higher on the scale throughout my first 2 years of high school, I began to worry. As my sophomore year came to a close, I was wondering when the weight gain was going to stop. A month after 10th grade ended, in June 1997, I had a tonsillectomy that set off a change in my eating habits. After the surgery, I could not eat normally for a couple of weeks, so I quickly dropped some pounds. The first time I weighed myself after this, I was at a gym near my home. I had joined a few months before so I could work out and lift weights to become a better softball pitcher. My goal at the time was a college scholarship to play softball, but that summer day would eventually change my life's direction. That day also marked an immediate change in my reasons for working out at the gym. I remember stepping on the scale, seeing that I'd lost 7 pounds, and being unsure how I felt. Part of me was a little uneasy because I knew weight loss would hurt my strength as a pitcher, but another part of me was excited. The tonsillectomy seemed to have resolved my dilemma about the weight I'd gained in high school. It was a perfect solution because I'd lost weight without technically dieting. My excitement was tempered by the knowledge that I would probably gain the weight back soon enough. My throat was healed and I could eat normally again. However, after seeing my weight loss, I was tempted to keep restricting my food intake. After all, I'd been successful at doing something many of my peers were trying to do, losing weight. So why would I want to gain it back? There was another factor that tipped the balance in favor of dieting. I was, just at the time, not motivated to work on my strength because I was facing a change of coaches. The night before my tonsillectomy, I found out my high school softball coach, who I admired and looked to for encouragement and direction, was no longer going to coach our team. I was quite upset about that and temporarily didn't care if my pitching would suffer and if I didn't gain the weight back. So, I decided not to go back to my carefree, healthy, normal eating habits. Instead, I chose to begin dieting, even though I didn't call it that. I would not eat normally again for nearly 8 years. Successes and failures. I began restricting my food slowly that summer. First by cutting out most junk food, then by eating fewer calories and exercising more. My family, my mom, dad, and older sister didn't